Okay, so last time we had already finished Yiftach. We started looking at the shoftim who followed Yiftach, and we get these three mini shoftim. That was the beginning of our conversation last time, which I wanted to wrap up this time, possibly start on Shimshon. But I came across an article which I had been trying to get for days, and this morning I finally got it, and I'm very glad I did, because it added a whole new dimension to these miniature shoftim that I think it adds a real depth to it that would have been missing without it. So that'll add at the end. But we have quite a bit to say still about these smaller shoftim. Remember that we have five mini shoftim altogether, assuming you don't count Shamgar. Right. Shamgar, who doubtless is distant in people's memories at this point, but he was one with a cattle goad. Right? He killed 600 Plishtim with a cattle goad. He was the one who was after Ehud. Ehud was the action hero, the one who had stabbed Eglon, king of Moab. So after that, you had Shamgar, who got all of one sentence at the end of Paragimel, and then you had Devorah, which kind of overshadowed people's memory of Shamgar. But Shamgar doesn't fit the profile of the miniature shoftim, because he at least has a war. There's an enemy, there's a war, there's something that makes him fit with the general model of shoftim. These five don't appear to have any of that. So the five were Tola and Ya'ir, right? Those were the ones from Perek Yud. And then we have Ivtzan, Elon, and Avdon in Perek Yud Bed. And we said the common denominator in these five is that you get the location where they were, you get their length of service, you get where they're buried. They all have the verb vayishpot, that they're involved in some element of whatever vayishpot refers to, judging, teaching, something. And they have no stories about what they did. With three of them, and these are the three that we're going to come back to at the end today, Ya'ir, Ivtzan, and Avdon, you find out about their wealth, and you find out about their children. And specifically, you find out they had a lot of children. We're talking 30, 60, 70, like, you know, very real numbers here. So the big question that we started discussing last time is, so why are these mini shoftim presented in a way that's different from the major shoftim? And we noted there are different answers. You know, one answer, the simplest possible answer, is to say that not much happened that was all that memorable. Sometimes you're a wartime president, and sometimes you're a peacetime president. So you get whatever you get within your day. Sorry.
Do we know if that was a peace period?
We don't. Then we have, only information we have is what they say. That's it. We know Yechezkel Kaufman's view that they, or he quoted a view, it wasn't, he actually didn't agree, but he quoted a view that suggests that they actually had different roles. There were shoftim who were the great charismatic military leaders, and then there were shoftim who judged, taught, and had a different type of position, and for all we know, there would be overlap. The weakness of it, which is why Kaufman doesn't like it, is the way that they're presented. You have two in sequence before Yiftach, and then you have three more afterwards. Like, if they're really of a set, then put them as a set. Don't scatter them in this very strange way. And also, the things that we do say about them are seen with the major shoftim. It's not that they're two different breeds. With the major shoftim also, you find out about their kids. Yeah, we found out about Gideon's kids. You know, all the 70 kids that he had. We're going to come back to them too. We have information about their burial sites with others. So it doesn't really work. So we did note an article by Rabbi Amichai Shoham. Right? Did I bring that? Oh, you know what? I brought it here. Just kidding. Right, because I wanted to come back to this, actually. I saw it after last week's shiur. I inserted it in my notes back there. But take a look at source number one. Now you'll see what Rabbi Amichai Shoham has to say. There's a very interesting website which is worth taking a look at, and it's where I found this piece. It's called hatanach.com, but Tanakh is spelled with a K instead of a C. I think it's by the Herzog School. And they have a Hebrew site, and they also have an English site. This comes from the Hebrew one, in which they endeavor to provide not just text and commentary, but they provide maps, they provide short articles and some links to longer articles that are very useful, particularly in a case like this where no one's really saying anything. You look at it and think, like, so what is going on in this story? Why do I have these miniature shoftim here? You get some interesting information. So for this, I bring you Rabbi Amichai Shoham, who offers the suggestion that actually the mini shoftim were the glue for the Jewish people. We had two of them who showed up after the business with Gidon and Avimelech, where Avimelech was such a catastrophe. Then you get Tola and Yair, and then you have the Yiftach turmoil, I don't know what to call it, and then you get three more of the miniature shoftim. So take a look at what he says in number one on your sheet. L'tanat Ya'ira Amit. According to Ya'ira Amit, and I don't know who she is, but he says, according to her, Hashoftim haktanim achin mishtalvim b'model shel ha-sefer. The mini shoftim do fit into the model of the book. Don't look at them as something separate. B'sefer yesh shiv'am machzorim shel chet onesh hatzalah. The book includes seven cycles of they sinned, they got punished, they were saved. Vashoftim haktanim mitzaynim et tkufot hasheket shel achar hatzalah. And these mini shoftim, they're the ones who they're the ones who mark the periods of quiet, the periods of peace after they've been saved. Kach l'dugma, so for example, yesh lahazvir ki tkufat Avimelech hayta onesh liYisrael. You can say, well, Avimelech's period is a period of punishment for us, and remember how disastrous that period of time was, all the bloodshed. And then, Tola ben Pua hoshiat Yisrael, mimenu heichela tkufat sheket shel arba'im v'chamish shana, 45 years. After Avimelech, you have Tola ben Pua, and you have 45 years of calm. So that's Ya'ira Amit's point of view. The bold in here is in the original. I didn't add that. But that's one point of view, which is these are the peaceful times. But he adds a note. Hesber zeh chosef meser nosaf shel hasefer. This explanation exposes another message of the book. Af la'achar kishalon hamalchut hakaful. Even after the double fall of the monarchy, shel Gidon va'Avimelech. Right, Gidon at the end of his life has this business with the ephod that he created, or really after his life, that leads people into Avodah Zarah, and then Avimelech with all of the bloodshed that and civil war that was involved. Yesh hashivut gedola l'retzav shiltoni. The message is, it's good to have continuity of authority. Haretzav hashiltoni moneya et hidardirut ha'am lachet. He says having an ongoing, continuous empire, or leadership, or monarchy, or rule, whatever they are, prevents the nation's descent into sin. V'rak hafsakat haretzef movila l'chata'ei am Yisrael. It's the interruption of that continuity that causes and enables the sins of the Jewish people. Parenthetically, l'fnei yimei Yiftach, l'fnei yimei Shimshon. Before Yiftach and before Shimshon, meaning you have the two mini shoftim, and then you get an interruption with Yiftach and the people sin. You have the three mini shoftim, and then you have, again, people descend into sin, and then you have the period of Shimshon. In Cain, if so, he says, Tzadak ish Yisrael kishabikesh melucha. If so, they were right when they wanted to have a king, which, is ultimately what follows on Shoftim. Sha'arei retzef shiltoni moneat hidardirut ha'am lematzav shabo kol ish b'Yisrael osay yashar beinav. Because the continuity is what prevents the situation in which each person does that which is right in his eyes. I thought it was a very interesting idea. So, it isn't enough for you to mention the great leaders, but the ones who are in between also matter. They also have a significant impact on the nation. So that was an interesting take. But we learned about.
But the Malkuth didn't last so many generations. They didn't wait so many generations until the Malkuth went into also disarray, into also.
Right. Well, that's the weakness with this, right? Having the monarchy didn't exactly help you. Meaning David, check. Shlomo, Shaul, whatever you want to call that. David, Shlomo, and then split and disaster. So I'm not so sure that the monarchy bears out all of the positive weight that he's giving it in this piece. But I thought it was an interesting view. We're going to see another view. That's the view. This was not the one that I found this morning. the other view I'm going to come back to at the end, because you need the perspective of seeing the mini shoftim, and then we can come back to this other view. But we saw Ibtzan. Ibtzan, who is from Beit Lechem, we noted that there are two Beit Lechem locations in Tanakh. One is the one in Zebulun, another one in Yehuda. There probably were more, just because Beit Lechem sounds like a generic name. It's not like it's the sort of name that's tied to a particular spot. It's the place where your food is. That's what it is. So, in any case, we know of Zebulun and we know of Yehuda. There are those who argue that this Beit Lechem is actually the Zebulun Beit Lechem, because the next shofet, Elon, is from Beit Lechem, is from Zebulun. However, the more logical read really seems to be the Beit Lechem that is in Yehuda, and we noted last time from Yecheskel Kaufman that it's Yehuda, because with Elon it says he's from Zebulun. So if you wanted to say that he's from Zebulun, you should have said so. You can make arguments one way, you can make arguments the other way. But I like the view that it's Yehuda, and it matters for where we go with this, the whole Ibtzan Boaz connection that we're going to explore today. We find out about Ibtzan, and let's open up the Navi, why not? I've been talking for 10 minutes. The Perek Yud Bet, chapter 12, sentence 9, the key statement that we think is important. What do you need to know about Ibtzan? He had 30 sons, 30 girls who he married off. And he brought in 30 girls from outside. Okay. 7 years of rulership. He died. And he's buried in Beit Lechem. Next. So why in the world do you care so much about the marriages of his kids? I mean, presumably, right, we read about Gideon, who had all those kids. We'd like to hope that some of them got married. I don't know. Is it saying he managed to marry off all his kids and it's a big simcha, so let's spread it in Tanakh?
It was saying it shows that he's like useful. No, it shows his stature, like he was a good man.
Right.
But,
so that was Radak's answer. Yeah. Radak says it could be because of the lesson coming regarding Boaz and Manoah, which we're going to have to talk about. Or alternatively, it's to say that that he had much success. He was really successful. God must have liked him. He was a really good man. The text didn't actually tell me anything about how we know he was good. Meaning, we know he's good because he successfully had all these kids and married them off. But what was good about him? Did he defend the Jews in a war? Did he establish Torah for... I don't know. But he must have been a good guy because he had family success. It just is a very strange read. And Abarbanel, we saw, actually took it as evidence for the opposite. Abarbanel said, the point is to say that your fortune in life is mazel. So Yiftach before him has one kid and loses the one kid. And on the other end, you get Ibtzan, who has 60 kids and manages to marry all of them off.
Maybe it's like he had only one kid and yet he had a whole section in Tanakh, and you can have a whole bunch of kids and
peace at the time.
We don't know that there was peace. We just know that we didn't mention the war.
But if we know that he's Boaz, then we have a whole of Megillah Ruth with the story of Boaz.
So he gets his story there. Mm-hmm. Although he doesn't really. I mean, what do we know about him in Megillah Ruth? Mm-hmm. We know he had fields. We know he had fields. We know that he was nice to Ruth. And we know that he married her, and in the end, David HaMelech. Right? That's basically what we get about him. But yeah, it is a story. And this is true. No, not just older, but much older. We'll have to talk about that. The other thing, though, that's particularly fascinating before we get into the whole Boaz story is this business of having 60 kids. So
that means he had a lot of wives.
So presumably that means he had a lot of wives. The article that I was reading this morning, he actually did a study looking at the stories where we do know how many wives and how many kids in Tanakh, and it's very clear that the women are not giving birth to large numbers of children. You know, I mean, Yaakov has 12 sons and a daughter, but he has 4 wives. And so he argued there has to have been at least 10 wives in this, in this story in order to get to this point.
So it's interesting because he only gives one.
Exactly. So Chanit Bartub, who I also saw on that website, she writes the following in source number 2. She's a teacher. She says, "V'kama nashim yoldu at 60 hayeladim halalu? How many women birthed these 60 kids? Umadu natan lebanav rak isha achat." And why is it that each of his kids only gets one? Is that my point? Is that the message?
He didn't want to have too many.
The starter one.
But maybe at that time, the father finds the first wife, and after that, he's on his own. He can find more wives for himself.
Yeah, no. I have no idea. I just throw up my hands and say this is all very interesting and could be. There's another approach though that you can take to this, which we're going to come back to at the end. But I'll start you thinking on it already. It's a major linchpin in the article that I'm going to use at the end of this section. But when you have 60 kids. Or Gidon has, 70 kids. Or even Yadier, when he has 30 kids. That doesn't happen by accident. This is intentional. It's not like you wake up one day and say, "Wow, honey, look at the family we created." They're trying to do something. There's a goal involved in having that many children.
That's status, wasn't it?
So maybe it's status, but we'll have to, I think it's an important point. I did see one person, I forget who it was, but I saw quoted, who said that it's because he's trying to give the Jews hope. It's always after these terrible things happen. So look, we can recover from this. We can recreate the Jewish people. And look, we're going to do it single-handedly.
We do that now as well.
Well, yes.
After the Holocaust.
Right. But there's more to say. But let's go into the Boaz Ibsen thing first, because we need to see the rest of this in order to appreciate what I'm going to bring at the end of it. This is a very interesting association. Source number 3. Gemara in Bava Basra. Amar Rava Barav Huna Amar Rav. Ibsen Ze Boaz. Rava Barav Huna quotes Rav saying, Ibsen is Boaz. Well, that's a really remarkable idea. So stop there for a second. Why do you associate Ibsen with Boaz? What's your evidence?
The only connection is
Bethlehem. Well, not just that. Right. The Megillah says, "Vayhi bimei shvod hashoftim." So it's during this period, and
it doesn't say
Boaz,
that he was a shofet.
It does not. However, he comes across as a leading figure in that period. And it's odd that you could go through Sefer Shoftim and never find him mentioned. So therefore, we get this idea, Ibsen equals Boaz. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 4, I brought you Roll Back.
But it doesn't mention the Megillah that he had all these kids. You'd think that if he had so many kids...
Yes, he would. Hold that question.
They would be helping in the field.
Hold that question, but you're not going to like the answer. Yeah. Take a look at number 4. Ulefisha Boaz Nira Meinyano Shaya Shofei Yisrael. Because from his story, it sounds like Boaz is a Shofet. V'haya mi Beit Lechem, and he's from Beit Lechem. V'lonim Tzabasho, and again, this assumes Beit Lechem Yehuda. V'lonim Tzabasho Tim Zulat Ibsan Shaya mi Beit Lechem. Ibsan's the only one we find in Shoftim who is from Beit Lechem. So Amar Abasein Uzal ki Ibsan Zeb Boaz. That's why they put them together. V'nachonu. And Ralbag says that makes sense. This is important, the fact that Ralbag says this makes sense, because Ralbag is a rationalist. Ralbag is not the sort of person you would expect to see approve of what sounds like a medrash with very little to go on. The fact that he is willing to say, "Yeah, I think I'm good with this idea that that Ibsen is Boaz," carries a lot of weight. So that's number 1. Number 2, both Ibsen and Boaz are wealthy. He didn't actually mention that, but we know that they're both figures of great wealth. And his name...
How do we know Ibsen's wealthy? I mean, I'm going to guess, because he has lots.
How do you know he's wealthy? Largely the kids and the... the ability to marry them off. Yeah, I suppose that would be the other piece.
He's also learned. We've all learned.
Ibsen?
No, Boaz. I don't know. We talked before about... Who was it who didn't know that he couldn't get out of the oath?
Right.
But Boaz knows, like, when Ruth comes, he knows that he can't just take her wife, he has to go to the next
relative, and
he knows the rules.
He knows the rules, and he knows to, you know, go and do that. So could that have anything to do with showing that?
Could be.
He was greater, he was more knowledgeable.
Possible. Possible. I mean, the question is always, do you know that which is sort of part of your agenda? You know, meaning, if he's really a judge.
Right.
Like, the most basic issues are inheritance issues.
Right, so I'm saying, as a judge, he would know these things.
Yeah.
Whereas...
Oh, you mean just part of credentialing?
Right.
I hear. The an interesting note, though, regarding his name. We've had five mini-shoftim, we said. Right? Our five mini-shoftim were Yair, was one. Tola was the second one. Ibzan here. Then we're going to get, after Ibzan, we're going to get Abdon, and we're going to get Elon. Of the five, four of them have names that show up earlier in Jewish history. These are good Jewish names with a pedigree. The only one that doesn't fit is Ibzan.
Ibzan doesn't even sound like a Hebrew name.
It really doesn't. It doesn't sound like one of ours. And here, there's a very interesting play on words which Rashi brings. I thought was interesting. Rashi and Divrei Hayamim says, Ibzan av lechol hatsin nunim. So I brought you in italics for those who can't read the Hebrew, so you could see it. Ibzan av snunim is a play on the name, and what it means, I added in brackets, father of all those who cooled themselves. And what it's talking about is the fact that he's alone at the granary at night, and Rus is there in the granary, and he doesn't act on anything. So that puts him as the father for all who cooled themselves. So Ibzan becomes a play on words, which is interesting. But I wasn't satisfied with this as an explanation of why we're associating Ibzan. And I mean, it still seems like something of a reach. So I saw two interesting ideas, which I don't think speak to why they are linked. I don't think it really addresses that. But I do think that it. But I do think it speaks to lessons that are learned from the link. Just trying to think which way to do this, because the truth of the matter is, you need to see the rest of the Gemara in order for this to make sense. So let's look at number three again. We'll go through the rest of the Gemara, prepare to be shocked, and then after that, we'll go back to the to these messages. Maika Mashmalan. The Gemara asks, so what does this teach us? We're in number three still, the middle of the first line. Maika Mashmalan. What does this teach us? This association of Ibzan with Boaz. Ki idach de Rabba bar Rav Huna. It teaches us another statement from Rabba bar Rav Huna. In addition to his statement quoting Rav that Ibzan is Boaz, he had another statement. Dama Rabba bar Rav Huna marak, because he said, quoting Rav, Meya ve'esr mishta'ot asa Boaz lebanav. Boaz, being Ibzan, marries off 60 kids. He made 120 wedding parties. Shneamar, vayilo shloshim banim shloshim banot shalachutz shloshim banot hevila banav minachutz veishpadisil shavashanim. Basically, the entire pasuk. I didn't bother to translate the whole thing. Ubechal achas veachas asa shnei mishtaos. For each one, he made two parties. Echad bebeis aviv, one in the father's house of the groom. Veechad beis chamiv, and the other one in the in-law's house. Ubechulan, that's the way to do it. The ubechulan lo zimein es. That's why he had all those wives, was to help him manage all of these parties. Ubechulan lo zimein es Manoach, but he never invited Manoach.
Why would even think like? Why bring him into
this? Well, Manoach is the father of Shimshon. They are not able to have children. Right, until this incident with the Malach.
So he didn't invite him because he was sensitive.
He didn't know that.
No, this isn't a happy story. Keep on reading. He's in Dun, apparently.
Well, he's not there, but no.
Yep. Well, look at the Gemara. Amar, he said, Hudna akara b'may para li. What is this childless mule going to do to pay me back? Meaning, he can't invite me to his kid's wedding.
Okay.
Yeah. Weird. It gets worse. Tana, and we learned, V'chulon mesu b'chayav. All of them predecease him. All of the kids.
All his 60 kids
predecease him. You ask the question of, so why don't his kids feature in Megillas Rus? The answer is they're gone.
So does that mean that does that mean Ovid is included in the sequel?
No, because that's the next one. Behainu Da'amri Inchi, here's the rest of the line, and that's what people mean when they say, Bechayecha de'yalda shisin, sorry, in your life when you have 60, shisin lamalech, what are 60 for you? Go again, have another child, and this will be more energetic than the 60, and that's the one who survives. So this is a really difficult Gemara.
And when he dies, say that particular phrase. I haven't heard that.
Yeah, well, you're hanging out in the wrong circles. It's an Ashkenazi thing.
That's it.
Go ahead, say it, and then we'll learn it.
Yeah,
what in the world is the connection? The whole thing is very, very strange, is just what I would say. It's not the style of the Gemara to do this. It's character assassination. We've taken somebody who we thought was a good man, and Amson, who we thought his worst offense may be what? Nothing. I mean, like, why have we just destroyed Ibsen the Shofet, and we've ruined Shavuos for all of you? Because you can read the Megillah, and you have this terrible looking Boaz.
And where do they get this from?
And where in the world is this coming from? So yeah, this is like, who did that? Why? So now I'll come back to what's going on. So, sorry?
Maybe he lived a very long life.
Yeah, he's way more than 80. According to this Medrash, he is way more than 80. We'll come back to it. According to this Medrash, he has to be way more than 80 years old. So a couple of notes. I'm going to change the order from what I have on the source sheet, because it's probably better to do it this way. The first question you have to ask is, does this have to be literal? Like, do we have to believe that this is actually there in the text? In general, you should know, when the Gemara does these naming associations, so there are always multiple views in the Gemara. There are debates. It's not like there's, like, this is the view and that's it. Meaning that you don't take it necessarily as Hermes Sinai, this is it, and there is no other way to view it. This is a view of Chazal, perhaps based on Pesukim, perhaps based on lessons that want to be taught. But I shouldn't say it's not Hermes Sinai, because it's a Gemara, so it is Hermes Sinai. But what I mean is, it's not the only possible read of it, and it may not be meant literally. One example is the Gemara that says Ezra is Malachi, but you have another Gemara that says that Mordechai is Ezra, and the three don't work. Like, you have to pick two and associate them. You can't satisfy all three. Radak, we saw last week, did not think this was necessarily so. I didn't bring it again on the source sheet, but Radak said he brought this idea that Ibsen is Boaz, and then he said, if that's the Kabbalah, fine. However, and then he went on with his own, simpler explanation. He did not think that you actually had to take this. Do you have the sheet from last week? Slow with his language.
Read that?
Yeah.
Our sages said, if son is Boaz, it appears to me that they said this because the text spoke of the marriages of his sons and daughters, and it placed Manoach beside this.
Right, well, that's, he's talking about our Gemara, about linking the two.
To teach that one should not be arrogant due to his welfare children. If son made 60 feasts for his sons and daughters, that's good. If it is a tradition for them. According to the Pshat, the text spoke of the marriages of his sons and daughters to tell of his great success with his sons, which is what we said before,
right,
and daughters, for he married off all of them in his lifetime. In truth, there were good things about him, and as a reward, he achieved his success and the great stature of becoming a Shofet of Israel.
Right, so Radak says, here's this idea from the Gemara, if it's a tradition, okay, but here's what I think the simple read of the Pesukim with the marriages is. So I don't think it's heretical if you don't take it literally. At the same time, we already saw Ralbag, who said Vinachonu, the association is accurate of Ibsen and Boaz. Whether he's talking about the marriages and the rest of the story or not, he sees this as being sensible. The association is sensible. And Rashi believes that it's sensible. Rashi in Divrei Hayyamim believes that it's sensible. If you take a look at source number 8, this is the business about how old he is. he's
Russia was full of
the pasuk says sorry.
Russia likes to follow me to Russia.
Yes, he does. No, but it's not the point. Look at what he says. V'salma holidet Boaz. Right, this is the Dibur Hayamim version of the chronology of the genealogy you find at the end of Rus. But Salma is the father of Boaz. So he says, Rabbi Seidu Amru, our sages said, Ibsan Zeb Boaz. So he says, V'tema. V'tema Yesh. Heyach Yachol Liyos. He says, how in the world could that happen? V'lo Nachshon, B'shana Shneel Yitzias Mitzrayim Meis. Nachshon died in the second year after the departure from Egypt, he says. I'm not sure how he knows that Nachshon is dead in the second year, unless he's going to say that it's because Nachshon wasn't sent as one of the Meraglim, so he must be, there was somebody else. Now, Kalev is now the head of Yehuda, maybe that's where he gets it, assuming they're in the sea, maybe that's how he knows it. But he says, Nachshon is dead in the second year in the wilderness. V'salmon b'no, meis kevar, v'hu hayam iba'eya aretz. And Salmon, his son, meaning the son of Nachshon, was already dead, and he was among those who entered the land. Uboaz bino shu ibtzan, and then Boaz is the son of Salmon. Bichnisaso la'aretz nolad. He is born upon entering into the land. Umiyitzias Mitzrayim ad Yiftach hayushlosh meos shana. But we already learned in the story of Yiftach, it's been 300 years since they left Egypt until that point. It's not even. It's actually 300 years from the time they entered the land. Until the time of Yiftach, right? Because that was 300 was from the time of Amon, from the time when we took their land. It's 340 years since we left Egypt. So he says, "Ve'echolid Boaz ben Gimel Meos Shana." How does Boaz have a child at the age of 300? He's really impressed. He says, "You know, it was a big deal that Avram and Sarah could have kids at 190, 100 years old for one, 90 for the other. That's nothing. He's 300 years old."
Why would you perform a levirate marriage if you're 300 years old? I mean, the whole purpose is to create a name.
Well, apparently it worked.
A miracle,
how do we know that it's the same Selma?
Well, because he's in the genealogical line, unless you assume that you're skipping generations. I'm not terribly bothered by that suggestion, that there are more generations in between and we're just not mentioning all of them. But he says this is the miraculous aspect of it, that Hashem gave her pregnancy, meaning that it was miraculous that she was able to conceive. Just like when Hashem showed Moshe the land, that's a miracle from Hashem for Moshe to be able to see the entire land. So to hear, Hashem enabled this pregnancy, even though it should not have been able to happen. He's not bothered at all by both living to 300. His problem is only, you know, fathering a child. From which I glean that there's always, you know, room for hope. You can live to 300, apparently. I don't know how people reacted when he went to the play with his kid, first grade. And everybody else is 25 years old. He came in for Grandparents' Day. But the point is that Rashi is taking this very literally. Like, Rashi is bothered. Well, wait a minute, how can you make this association? Ibsan and Boaz, that has to mean that he's 300 years old if he's that late in the period of the Shoftim. And Rashi has problems with that idea. I bring it again in order to show there are those who take it literally. Ralbag took not necessarily the second half of it, but the first half of the statement, the equation of Ibsan and Boaz, he says, yeah, that makes sense. I don't know about the rest of it with the children, but here's your problem. And I think this is a major point in this. I think once we are talking about Ibsan equals Boaz, number one. And number two, as Alina said, we don't see the kids, so something must have happened. There must be some reason why all of these kids that Ibsan had are not around in Megillas Rus. So what the Gemara is doing is it's assuming that actually they're not around because they're gone. And they're gone as a punishment to him for some for this wrongdoing.
Well, if he lived to 300, maybe they did not have the school to live that long. They decided 120 or something, so that he didn't have kids.
Right. Maybe they just didn't live the 100 years for some reason. So there is a medrash which says that his wife died on the day that Rus came to town. There is indeed such a medrash. Yeah, which wife it was, we don't know.
Also, his name Boaz is sort of like a strong, like it indicates strength.
Right.
So he was standing up.
Could be. So just in terms of this loss of the children, a couple of notes. First of all, remember that in Rus itself, in Perek Gimel, I gave you the reference in source number 9, Boaz talks about her chesed to him. If the story is this story that he had children, then he lost them, and now he has nothing, so that's her chesed that she's doing for him, which is greater than her initial chesed, as described there in Rus. It said your later chesed is greater than your earlier chesed. Your earlier chesed was to Naomi. You took care of this aged widow. Now you're taking care of Boaz, this very aged widower. So that's part of it. And also, it fits with Ploni Almoni's remarks. Right? Remember the story. Ploni Almoni is the closest relative. He's the one who's supposed to marry Rus. He doesn't want to marry Rus. Why didn't he want to marry her? He's concerned about inheritance issues because his estate is supposed to be called now on the name of the deceased former husband of Rus. He isn't interested in diluting his estate and messing things up for himself, but the way he says it makes it sound like, and you, Boaz, don't have any such concerns. Why doesn't Boaz have any such concerns? Because his kids are gone. Mm-hmm. Not 300 kids. Let's not replay this.
Isn't that a problem that a 300-year-old man should be marrying a girl to have children with her when he's 300? I mean, that part I have a little bit.
Well, it is also taking care of her, bringing her into the family so she'll have the means of survival.
It's a liberate marriage in order to create
a child.
But that's not the sole reason.
The other issue really is historically taking care of the widow.
So he's by himself, I'm sorry, in the Goran threshing or whatever wheat at 300 years old, like not worried, you know.
By himself.
Like I said, he's Boaz.
And he's rich. He was wealthy. Why would he be that?
And the answer is this is how he got wealthy. He didn't hire people.
He did it himself. To eat with the Na'ari.
Right.
Well, he enjoys
that. He did have some. Look, there's a limit. He's 300 years old. He slowed it down at 290. He hired some staff. But also, they give a bracha to Boaz, right? In Perek Daled, when Rus and Boaz are going to get married, so there's that bracha that the townspeople give that she should build up his household because he doesn't have a household anymore. That's that will be the fit. It would also explain the loss of his children will explain why he is managing the fields himself, right? Overseeing the fields, even if he's not doing the actual harvesting, but he's overseeing everything himself. And it also explains why he is these pieces fit. Once you're willing to accept Ibzan equals Boaz, and your logical next question is, so what happened to all of his kids? The idea that the kids have actually died isn't the craziest idea. What is the craziest idea is how he died. This idea that it's a punishment for him not inviting Manoah is a very hard thing to understand. So now I want to go back to the sources that I skipped and show you two interesting ideas. Because like I said, when I was dealing with these mini shoftim, normally when I do this, I'll be satisfied by looking at classic Mefarshim, Gemara Medrash, and whatever I've come across, and then other books in Tanakh that might sort of blend in with what you see here and connections you can make. But on the mini shoftim, there was very little written until our own day.
The age of death isn't always equivalent to sin.
That's true. But the Gemara seems to want to teach us something. And that's exactly the question, is what does the Gemara want to teach? So I bring you two pieces here. One from Yael Ziegler, and actually the other one, I see that I didn't bring you a quote from it on the page, but the other one will be from Rabbi Chaim Angel. So she wrote the following on the Gush website, and I thank Rabbi Ziering for mentioning this to me. It's an interesting read. I don't necessarily agree, but I think it's an interesting read anyway. She says, if Boaz is indeed Ivtson, then we learn two important things about Boaz. First, we know that he has 60 children, right, by making this equation. In other words, he does not need to marry Ruth for his own continuity. Now, here I believe she's made a mistake. I actually sent an email via the website. I'm waiting to see if she, you know, if she gets it and responds. Who knows with website contact forms, you know. But I think that's simply a mistake, because the same Gemara that said Ibsen equals Boaz is the Gemara that said that he lost all his kids and therefore does need continuity. But the rest of her piece is important here. While in the Book of Ruth we have no information regarding Boaz's family, the identification of Boaz with Ibsen suggests that Boaz's intention in marrying Ruth is completely selfless from the perspective of desiring progeny. This is very important to support my assertion that Boaz parallels Ruth, whose selfless behavior is the hallmark of the narrative. That's her first point, that he's doing it selflessly, he doesn't need the child, and again, that part I disagree with. But the next part is important.
With my grandchildren, does that give you any? Like, you're going to assume that these 60 children all have children.
That's a good question. They don't bother to take that into consideration.
So he could have progeny, you know. Is that still here?
Maybe. Could be. I suppose it could be. We don't get any mention of that, so we don't know.
Right. That's what she's saying. He doesn't need.
Assuming that there were descendants, yes. Yeah. Second, she says, this identification with Ibsen indicates that Boaz is not averse to external marriages, that he's not xenophobic, right? Because Ibsen has these kids and he goes to outside of the family out in order to get spouses, and that he would presumably be able to allow for a qualified foreigner to become part of his family. Boaz's identity as Ibsen prepares us for his willingness to marry Ruth later in the story, despite the Goel's reservations, right, when he said, I don't want to mess up my lot. This medrash launches our hope and expectation that Boaz will be the heroic solution to the problem of finding a husband for Ruth the Moabite. So I thought that was an interesting perspective. It sort of fleshes out Boaz's willingness to marry Ruth. I'm not 100% sure, because his willingness to marry Ruth only comes about because of her relationship with Naomi, because she's in the family. It's not as though he went out looking for Moabites to marry. It's this Moabite that who he's going to marry. Nonetheless,
well,
I thought
maybe he just the sense you get when you read the Megillah is that he kind of fancied her.
Well, he says he admires her chesed and what she's done. He's heard about what she's done, and she's an Eishes Chayil and so on. Yes, the point that she's making is an interesting one, that Boaz is not afraid to go out, and Ibsen is not afraid to go out, and I think it does, in that sense, have some element of consistency for the two of them. What it does not do at all is address our problem with the dead, you know, kids. Like, that is not addressed. So the second piece, Rabbi Chaim Angel, in an audio recording of a shir that's available on YU Torah, it's a series of three shirim on Rus, so this is from his third shir, suggests that the association is actually meant to portray Boaz in a harsh light. Mm-hmm. That's actually what's going on. No.
Oh. No.
I will, but not yet. It's actually meant to put Boaz in a harsh light.
That Boaz is it? Something?
That, no, specifically this business with the marriages. This business about about not inviting Manoah to the party. And it comes back to a basic question about our story. How does Boaz choose to help Ruth? What does he do?
He tells her to leave.
Go out and glean behind the men, right? Whatever you can get, you know, you'll collect it. It ends up being quite a bit. I mean, she gets an Ava, she gets a monstrous amount.
He tells the men
not to bother her, right?
But he also said
yeah.
earlier.
Tell me something.
Safer.
Well, that's a separate piece of it. But I mean, the general chesed is the food. But is that very nice? You're Boaz. You're wealthy. You have fields and fields and fields and employees and employees and employees. You have all this grain. Tell me something. You couldn't just, at the least, when she shows up in the morning, say, here, take this, exactly. Go home. If not, deliver it to the house. And now it's not humiliating. You have to walk around through the field picking up the grain that other people dropped. That's not humiliating.
Or invite her and Naomi for dinner.
To quote Rabbi Angel in his shir, gleaning is not a respectable trade. Gleaning is the equivalent of walking around with your pushka door to door, you know, give me your throwaway stuff. This is not more respectful to her. It may be more industrious, you know, and good exercise. But, you know, the point is, there are two different ways you can look at Boaz. And in one way, none of the ways you can look at him are bad. He's clearly a hero. But there are different types of heroes.
Maybe he's testing her.
Testing her? Okay. To determine
what kind of character she has. Is she willing to bend down and pick up all this luggage? Or, you know, is she...
Yeah, at that point, she's not up for marriage. Just in general, like, he's an interesting person. Let's see how much they can take.
Because he likes Naomi, he wants to know more about her just because he's concerned for Naomi.
Could be. It could be.
But he noticed her before he knew who she was. He asked, right. Who is that? So something about her impressed him. Otherwise,
yes.
He wouldn't have asked
her. Well,
I'll
know how many people come true. Do that. Like, is it common that people
thought she was foreign?
She looked foreign.
Well, take a look at this Medrash in Vayikra Rabbah, source number 7. This is what Rabbi Angel uses for this. He said, he quotes the Medrash, which is usually quoted in terms of Reuven. Lemdascha Torah derech eretz. The Torah taught you proper conduct. When you do a mitzvah, do it with a joyous heart. At the sale of Yosef, right? They're going to kill Yosef. And Reuven says, no, don't kill him. Throw him in the pit. Right? With a plan that later on he's going to get him out. So had he known this was going to be recorded in the Torah, that Hashem was going to cause Moshe to write down, and Reuven heard and he saved them, Hayatano umolicha etzel aviv, he would have put him on his shoulders and carried him back to his father. And had Boaz known that there's going to be a book written in which it's going to say, and he gave her parched grain, he would have fed her fat calves. He's not going to give her, yeah, sure, you can go around gleaning in the field. The message here, and this is what our angel plays out, is that that our Gemara, with its line about Boaz not inviting Manoah because there's nothing in it for him, takes the less than stellar view of Boaz. One view of Boaz is, he's a hero, stop questioning him. He took care of this Moabite girl. He helped when no one, you know, there was no obligation. Ploni Almoni refused. You know, Boaz would have been within his rights to say, I'm not interested, and that was what everybody expected, quite frankly. And one way you could look at him is a simple, pure hero. Another way to look at him is as a human being, which is, yes, he helped, but there was more that he could have done. Yes, he made these great big feasts, but he wasn't interested in Manoah. So I don't like doing this to a figure in Tanakh. I certainly don't like doing this to Boaz. I like Boaz, but nonetheless, I think there is something to be said for it, and the Gemara is clearly doing this by equating Boaz and Ibsan and giving us this story about how his kids died. Right, it's bad enough that his kids are dead because Boaz is Ibsan and his kids don't show up in the Megillah. But now we've made things much worse by assigning guilt to the parties. So I'm going to come back to one other idea about this in a minute. But first, let's read the other two of the miniature shoftim, and then I'm going to give you a wrap-up idea, which I just think is fascinating from that essay that I read this morning. Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayishvorach Rav es Yisrael Elon haZivuloni, Elon of Zivulon. He is the one who we know is from Zivulon. Was the next shofet. Vayishvorach es Yisrael Eser Shanim. He judged Israel for 10 years. Vayomas Elon haZivuloni, and then he died. Vayikaver ba'ayalon be'eretz Zivulon. He's buried in Ayalon in Zivulon. Yes, Elon Ayalon. We've seen Gilad before. We've seen Ya'ir and Ya'ir before. So the idea that someone has a name that's associated with the place where he lives is not the end of the world. This Ayalon, though, is in Zvulun. This is not the Ayalon of Yareach Be'emek Ayalon. That's a different Ayalon. Okay. We don't know anything about Ayalon. Vayishpodach Rabbis Yisrael, Avdon Ben Hillel. Oh, the only thing that... No, sorry, no, we don't know anything. I thought I had something in my notes, but I don't. Vayishpodach Rabbis Yisrael, Avdon Ben Hillel, HaPir Atoni. Then comes Avdon, son of Hillel, of Pir Aton. Okay. Pir Aton, according to the Dat Mikra, is somewhere southwest of Shechem. All right. You wanted grandchildren? Here you go. He had 40 sons and 30 grandsons. Rochvim al shivim ayarim, and collectively they rode on 70 donkeys. Vayishpodes Yisrael shmona shanim. He is the shofet for 8 years. Vayomas Avdon ben Hillel haper atoni, and then he dies. Vayikaver bepir aton beeretz Ephraim b'har ha'amaleki, and he's buried in Pir Aton, Eretz Ephraim, in Har ha'amaleki. Some of the commentators are a little curious about this Har Amalek thing, but according to the Dat Mikra, it's part of this region, the mountainous region that's in Ephraim, south of Har Gerizim. So what we have in this is, again, the three mini shoftim, Ibzan with his 30, right? 30 sons and 30 daughters. And then Elon, we don't know anything about his kids. And then Avdon, who has the 40 sons and 30 grandsons. So here I bring you to this last article. Rabbi Michal Rottenberg in Israel, I don't know what he's associated with, yeshiva community, I don't know, wrote an article called, sorry? No, I just saw it this morning and didn't redo the sheets. The article is called Boaz Hu Ivtson Limashma Uto Shel Hazihui. Boaz equals Ivtson. What is the meaning of this identity? Why are we identifying them together? And he says, go back to Gidon. Remember that after Gidon was successful in the war, before Gidon was successful, when Gidon was first identified, the Navi comes to Gidon and says, you're going to help save Israel. Gidon's response to him is, Alpi Hadal B'Menashe. My tribe is the weakest, the smallest in Menashe. We're tiny, we have no influence, who are we to lead? Right? That was his initial thought. However, after the military victory, we then find out that he produces 70 kids, which, as noted, doesn't happen by accident. He has to have a lot of wives, and he has to be doing this for a reason. The people approach him and say, we want you to lead, right? Remember? Not just you. You, your kids, and your descendants. He says, I don't want this position of hereditary leader. We noted that there were two different ways to take that, whether he actually out declined or whether he was saying, I'm not leading you, God is leading you, but I'll be involved, right? Two different views. But he sees a need for leadership. He creates that ephod, right? From the rings, from the battle. He creates the gold ephod. And he produces 70 kids. And what Rabbi Rottenberg suggests is that his goal is to create a group from whom the leaders would come. Because 70 is a leadership number. What is 70? Sanhedrin. But in the Torah itself, the 70 is a Kenim, right? Who are going to assist Moshe. And what did Abimelech say? Abimelech, when he told the people of Shechem, you want to support me? He said, better to be ruled by one man alone than to be ruled by 70. That's the idea. And there's a similar model. There's a story with Achav. Achav also has 70 kids.
So 70 languages, too?
I don't think in the Psukim.
No, that's not.
There could be, you mean the idea of 70 languages? Yeah, that goes back to the 70 descendants of Noach. So Gideon has a plan. He feels that what the Jews need for their leadership is something more stable than just the one shofet. Because look what happens, shofet after shofet, they die, and then the people fall into disarray. They die, people fall into disarray. Sometimes they don't wait for him to die before they fall into disarray, like with Ehud. But Gideon's plan is to correct the shofet model by creating instead some kind of a group leadership model out of his own family. But Gideon's plan is dynamited by the one kid who was excluded from the 70, which is Abimelech. Right? Abimelech comes along and he kills the 70. After this whole thing with Abimelech, you have this brief shofet Tola ben Pua, who we don't know about. But then, the next shofet is Ya'ir HaGiladi. Ya'ir HaGiladi has 30 kids riding donkeys and controlling cities. The act of riding the animals is a sign of leadership. Right, Devorah talks about Rochvei Atanot Scharot Yoshvei Al Midin, the people who were the leaders who rode the white donkeys. David's kids are described also specifically as riding on animals. It's leadership. Rabbi Rotenberg shows that 30 is used in different places in Tanakh for a unit, like a military unit. You find the use of the 30. So he's come up with an improved model. Ya'ir is not going to make the mistake that Gideon made. 70 is too large a group. It's too overpowering. It's too frontal a statement of I'm going to take over. So 30 is his goal. But his plot gets dynamited. Who dynamites the plot of Ya'ir HaGiladi? Who comes along next? Yiftach. Yiftach is the one who comes along next. Yiftach, who was the son of somebody named Gilad, right, from the same region. Whether Gilad is Ya'ir HaGiladi is a stretch, I think. He mentions it as a possibility in the article, but fine. But the point is, remember, who dynamited the first plan? Abimelech, who had been excluded. Along comes Yiftach, who has been excluded. He was the one from the Zona, and therefore they kicked him out. And Yiftach, in this case, destroys the plan. He takes over, right? They come to him, they say, well, you lead us, and the nightmare that comes with it. And Yiftach, oh, it's too strong, but it's certainly a debacle, not a nightmare, fine. And then Yiftach is followed by Itzan. Itzan has another way to improve the model. He has 30 sons and he has 30 daughters, but look at the emphasis. It's on the marriages, right? Marrying his sons out to others and taking men from outside to marry his daughters, he's going to create family connections. Alliances, exactly, yes. It's political alliances. That's an improved model. He's very pragmatic in this. And this is why I do this after reading about Boaz and Yiftach in particular, because he says that's the pragmatism that is in the Gemara's understanding of Yiftach. Right? He's only interested in inviting you if there is some way that that's going to strengthen his hand. So he marries off his kids to people who he thinks will make an alliance, and you get invited to the party if you have something to bring. If you're able to contribute to his standing. That's the way that he views what happens with Elon. And then the last one with this is Abdon ben Hillel, who in this case has 40 sons, and then he has the 30 grandsons. So it's across two generations. It's less forward an attempt to shape the future leadership of the Jewish people. So that what you're seeing here is a cycle across these shoftim, a pattern that develops, which never works, because in the end each of these collapses. The next one's going to be Shimshon, the loner, you know, the ultimate loner, really, as we'll see. But what you're getting here is an attempt to try to come up with a new leadership model, leadership via a group, and each time they try with a little bit of a change, with a little bit of an improvement, but it ultimately falls apart. That was a very interesting take on this, and it helps to explain why we have all this emphasis on large numbers of kids and on the marriages of Ibsen's kids. Thank you very much.
Thank you.